Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Karwoski.
Welcome to the Social Network Show. I'm Jane Karwoski, experimental psychologist, Dr. J, along with my co-host Jim Nico, founder and CEO of the Social Network Intermedia, LLC. Today, we're very privileged to have Lance Cottrell, internet security and anonymizer and intrepid veteran and CEO and so on. Lance, welcome to the Social Network Show.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.
You can correct me on that. I forget your exact position at Intrepid.
I'm chief scientist.
There you go. Okay. So the reason I wanted to see if you could possibly talk to us today, and I thank you very much for jumping on board here, is the big news of the billion-some usernames and passwords being hacked. Can you give us a few of the facts about that report?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, this has certainly got everyone excited online. So a company called Hold Security, which interestingly no one had really ever heard of before, came out and announced that they'd gotten a hold of over a billion usernames and passwords that had been stolen by a criminal Russian gang, which they immediately set up a service offering to let you check to see if your password had been stolen for a fee, which is kind of an unusual behavior for a security company. But
right.
There are some other security experts out there who say that these are, in fact, good guys. And it appears that the database is legitimate, that there are a billion passwords in there.
And what is the website there? Do you know that?
It's Hold Security.
Okay.
I think it's just holdsecurity.com.
Okay. Thank you.
So they are proposing, they are not purportedly the hackers themselves.
That's what they're saying, and that appears to be true. These the guys behind it evidently have a long history of infiltrating and getting inside these hacker organizations. So what it appears has happened is Hold Security was able to get their hands on the database that the Russian gang had pulled together. But what looks interesting is it's not clear that these are very new passwords. A lot of these may have been stolen quite some time ago and or stolen from not very sensitive websites, because the methodology that they used apparently is very simple. They used well-known database vulnerabilities and what's called a botnet to just scan basically every website on the internet, and then just real quick check to see whether the site's vulnerable to this kind of database exploit. And if it is, they'd then go in and suck down the database of usernames and passwords. But the reality is any serious website, major e-commerce, banking, financial sites, have long since been tested for these kinds of vulnerabilities. So they're either old or for websites that don't care much about security and haven't, maintained their testing.
So if a person were to discover that their username and password was on that list, probably a good move would be to quit that site?
Well, certainly you'd want to change passwords. And this really emphasizes the reason why password reuse is such a problem. Because if there's some movie review website that you log into, and you just fundamentally don't care if someone hacks your account on this movie review website. And frankly, the movie review website isn't paying much attention to security either. But if you use the same email address, username, or password on your bank, then hacking that movie review site that you didn't care about suddenly matters a lot, because hackers are smart enough to try every username and password they find on every other website that they care about.
Okay.
Although this is another interesting fact, is that we're seeing a lot of spam coming out of these compromised accounts, but we're not seeing reports of banking compromises. So that's also kind of an odd thing about this whole big hack. There's a lot of things that just don't quite line up to the security community.
That fee really kind of makes me nervous. I mean, all of a sudden, here's a company, and I believe you about their being legitimate, but all of a sudden they make this announcement, and then they charge a fee for us to go in, and we've never heard of them. I don't know. That makes me a little nervous.
How much are they charging?
Originally the website popped up and said $210, and now they're saying it was actually supposed to be $20 a month. So
holy mackerel!
It's a lot, and there's some debate because they've since kind of pulled that back off the website, whether that was for individuals or for websites to see whether they'd been compromised. But another weird thing is, to check, they ask you to upload your password.
Oh, dear.
You never upload your password to any website. You know, that sort of violates all the rules and kind of makes you question what kind of security company would be endorsing that.
Right.
Yet another one of those things. Everything just seems a little odd about this.
Okay, and what, for the layman, and including me, what do you mean by uploading a password?
Sending it to them, or...
On the website, yeah, apparently. I mean,
wow.
this again has been taken down, I gather, but it was saying just type in your password.
Oh,
and
geez.
They were claiming they were going to immediately hash it, and maybe they were even going to hash it using a script in the page so it wouldn't get sent in the clear. But, you know, you sort of have to trust them, and it's reinforcing bad habits. You know, the reality is you should never be typing in your password anywhere except the website you're trying to go to. And even then, you always want to make sure that you actually typed in the name of the website or followed your own bookmark, not clicking on a link in an email or something that could have been faked.
Okay.
Of course, phishing is a huge problem, you know, fake links and emails and so forth.
Wherein you give some kind of information and then it's used by the unscrupulous creator of the link.
May I ask a question,
right,
too? Just a simple question. Like, one of the things I'm wondering about email, and if you're comfortable answering this, I get these ridiculous emails, et cetera. And then there's a button where I can say, block the site or block the domain or whatever. Is there a preference there, a better thing to do that, you know, because I'm getting some crazy emails and I don't want them. You know, I know they're spam, but any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so, I mean, if it's a fairly legitimate company that is spamming you, then the unsubscribe link is probably for real.
Okay.
But if you're getting some kind of weird thing, that unsubscribe link is probably really just validating that your email address is real and you did, in fact, open and read that email.
Mm-hmm.
And you're likely to get more spam.
Yeah, and I'm not even seeing an unsubscribe. This is like someone who pretends they know me, you know.
So then that's just a phishing attack.
What do you do there? Do you block it with block sender or domain? Is there any ideal thing to do there, or just purge it?
You know, the problem is they change domains so fast that
okay.
by the time you block that domain, they've probably moved on.
Okay.
They may also be spoofing the sender, because
okay.
I get spam email from my friends. Or at least it appears to be from my friends. It's from their email address and with their name. But the reality is someone's just gotten their name and email address, and then is faking emails
okay.
from those addresses.
Yeah, I think that
looks real to me. And the problem is it's trivially easy to fake emails
okay.
When you send it.
So they don't necessarily, usually if something like that happens, I get an apology email from someone saying, my email was hacked. But is it actually the case that their email that the spoofer got into their account and sent from their account, or are they just masquerading?
Both happen.
Uh-huh.
So in some cases, someone's hacked the account and is sending it for real. In other cases, people have just masqueraded as you, and without looking really closely at the internal headers that are hidden in the email, it's actually pretty hard to tell the difference.
By the way, if you don't mind me asking, is there any, I'm not asking for an endorsement per se, but is there any really good email out there as far as emails go that is versatile and user-friendly and has some good tools? And again, I'm not asking for an endorsement, but maybe just something better than I have, you know?
You know, it's all about the trade-offs. For example, Gmail has some of the best spam filtering out there. Just because they see so much email, they can really build very accurate models.
Okay.
On the other hand, they read all your email to, you know, target ads at you, and you know, the way they're hosting it is open to subpoenas and all sorts of other things. So you've got a real loss of control there. You know, whereas you could go to a small company which just provides you the email and is probably treating it with more care and values your privacy more, but their spam is nowhere near as good.
Okay.
So,
anybody
kind
come?
Of a catch 22 there.
Yeah, is there anybody in the middle that, you know, I'm not, again,
has the best of both worlds?
Yeah, but, you know, like, I mean, I'm not asking what you use, but if you wanted to tell me, I would. You know, we get experts that, you know more than we do.
You know, I've sort of given up on trying to stop the spam and prioritize privacy.
Okay.
And I've got several email addresses. I have some attached to domains that I bought. And
okay.
I actually use Apple's email service just because, you know,
is that
I'm their customer as opposed to the advertiser being their customer.
What's that called? Is it Apple email?
It's, what is it, iCloud.
iCloud. Oh.
Oh, okay. So we're beyond the Hotmail.com. Wasn't that an Apple?
No, that was Microsoft, I think.
That was Microsoft.
Oh, okay. Well, of course.
So
it's not on my
iMac. It was MobileMe, and then me.com. It was .Mac. It was It's iCloud.
Thank you.
Now, I kind of steered away from iCloud because I thought, oh, no, that means I'm putting everything under the sun on their server. But I suppose it's already on their server, huh?
Well, you know what? It's one of those things. I do try to spread the risk out. So I've got my email with Apple, and my calendar is just local. And then I have, you know, all my searching is generally through Google, and I use Google for videos and some other kinds of purposes. And of course, Facebook and Twitter I'm active on. But I try to distribute the risk a little bit so that no one entity kind of has 100%.
And you're an expert. Of course, Anonymizer, your ingenious invention, I guess you would call it, unless you correct me. But I want folks to know about Anonymizer. I'm really interested in that myself. And as things like calm down a little bit for us, I want to look at it. Can you give us some more information on Intrepid and how people can get a hold of and utilize this ingenious invention of yours, Anonymizer?
Sure, yeah. So Anonymizer is really designed to allow consumers to hide their activities online so that they can't be tracked and identified. And it's at anonymizer.com, A-N-O-N-Y-M-I-Z-E-R.
Okay.
Because no one can spell it. And what you do is that sets up a VPN. So now all of your traffic, instead of going directly to the website, bounces off our servers before going there. Because the IP address, the unique machine identifier of your computer, is the one thing that you can't hide yourself. That's always being sent to the destination. So by using Anonymizer, you can block that.
Thank you.
And then you can go out and set up, say, a new Gmail account that's only ever accessed through Anonymizer or a new, you know, whatever service you want to use. And then that wouldn't be tied back to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, and I have some questions on the whole idea of the password being broken, and also the conference that the meeting you were here in Las Vegas for recently. So let's go into that in our next segment.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
Kelly Keller, an intellectual property attorney specializing in internet law and social media issues. Join me on The Kelly Keller Show right here on the Social Network Station. Together with my guests, we will tackle tough legal problems presented by the ever-increasing use of social media in everyday business. Through dynamic conversations, we will discuss your rights and responsibilities in the new media world so the hard work you have put into developing your brand, business, and products does not go to waste. How does the law's response to the social media explosion affect you? Join me on The Kelly Keller Show to learn more.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show and our visit with Lance Cottrell. And I want to mention his blog is excellent. ThePrivacyBlog.com has wonderful posts about things that are intriguing and keeps us up to date. So, Lance, we know that you've told us previously that there is the concept that passwords are broken, the whole password system. What does that mean, and what are the alternatives?
Well, I think the real problem with passwords fundamentally is that computers have just gotten really, really fast. And it used to be people would say, oh, you know, as long as your password's 4, 5 letters or 7 letters, no one's going to crack it. The reality now is that if you can remember the password, it can almost certainly be hacked and cracked by an attacker in a fairly short amount of time. So you're stuck with this catch-22 where you should be using, you know, 10, 15, 20 character long passwords that are completely random. They're not words. They're not made up of parts of words. And of course, that's no possibility of remembering them. Oh, and you can never reuse them. As we talked about earlier, if you ever reuse a password, then it gets compromised in one place and you are in trouble somewhere else.
Okay, and last time you gave us a couple names of companies that specialize in that, providing you with a new password scrambled every time you log into anything. And what are those again?
I personally use a program called 1Password, just the number 1 and then password. There's one called LastPass. There's a number of these that are called password vaults that are really useful, so you can manage them all in one place. But the reality is most people don't, and so there's a lot of thought going into what can be the next generation of passwords, what's beyond passwords. And so people are working on what's called multi-factor authentication.
Wow.
So a password is something you know.
Okay.
And can you add something else?
Such as your iris scan or something?
Well, it could be biometrics, right? An iris or a thumbprint. Or it could be something you have with you. So it's, you know, if you've ever seen people with these little RSA fobs that have numbers that change every couple of seconds.
Yes, I had one of those once.
And with Google, actually, you can set up two-factor authentication, and they'll give you some software that runs on your cell phone.
Oh,
and so
that's
now, in
right.
addition to typing in your password, you type in the code that pops up on your cell phone, which changes every couple of seconds. And so even if someone steals the code, it won't be useful to them in 30 seconds.
What's that called from Google?
It's the Google Authenticator.
Wow.
And there's a couple of other services that are starting to use it. So multi-factor is the next another thing that people are starting to use.
Wow, interesting. Cutting edge, fascinating. The inventor of anonymizer, folks. I mean, this is what we need to know, because it wouldn't take a whole lot. I mean, in this day and age, with the speed of computers speeding up and hackers getting smarter and some of us getting a little bit dumber, I speak only for myself, we need all the help we can get online.
We'd like to know what the latest thing you're talking about on your blog is.
Oh, you know, there's lots of stuff going on. I haven't posted about it yet, but it was actually just out in Las Vegas at an event talking about securing the Internet of Things.
Oh, okay.
Because now
it's
not just your computer or your phone. You know, everything is getting smart, and it opens up so many vulnerabilities. I posted, I guess it was a few weeks ago now, about someone who demonstrated the ability to hack smart light bulbs. So you can actually buy, buy light bulbs
it was
that you
me.
Can control from your phone.
It was
yes.
me. Yeah,
yes,
I did it.
Very good point to bring up, because
light bulbs?
It makes me really nervous, but our Blu-ray player quits, so we get a new one. And the first thing is they want you to network it with your home network and the apps that are available. You're going, please, I just want to play my Blu-ray disc.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember there was a quick story. There was a special I saw. I think it was on 60 Minutes at one point. And there was a guy on there, a professor, a retired professor, and he was talking about how the inventors of the televisions and the remotes, you know, that we try to learn, had no connection with reality in terms of us using them. And then, you know, the old saying where they say, well, you got to have a degree, you got to be from MIT to use the remote. And he said, I am a professor at MIT, and I couldn't do it. Yeah. So it's like...
Yeah.
Right. No. So it's all getting complicated. But also, you know, like with a light bulb, people don't bother securing it because they figure, who cares if someone hacks my light bulb, except that it's on your network. And what this guy was able to do was, by hacking the light bulb, then pivot and start getting information about the network to allow him to attack that directly. And, you know, there's smart refrigerators, you know, that keep track of what's in them, and someone compromised them and is using them to send out spam.
I knew my refrigerator
was up to something early. About 3 a.m. I got a signal. You know, I got an email from, that's amazing. Well, what is safe? Is there anything safe out there?
You know, it's a real problem. And fortunately, people are, you know, like at this conference, starting to get really active in thinking about the whole Internet of Things phenomena and how to secure it. And it's going to require a really different way of thinking, because no one's going to install and maintain, you know, antivirus software on their microwave. It's just not going to happen.
Yes. So were there any...
The whole paradigm needs to change.
Any insights or little epiphanies from the conference on the Internet of Things?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of sort of thinking about how to make things self-patch, making sure that things update themselves. And a lot of it was just making sure that the incentives are correct for the makers, so that, you know, there were some lawyers there who were saying this probably won't change until there's some big lawsuits against companies that forces them to wake up and prioritize putting security on these devices, rather than just sort of saying, well, it's not that important. I'm not a bank. You know, who cares if someone hacks my light bulb?
It was a real wake-up call. When I remember the wake-up call I'm talking about is when I'm not saying that it came just from the government, but when I heard, and I'm not sure this is true, that someone can listen on my cell phone if it's even turned off, that there's someone on the other end of these phones that can then tap into what we're saying. And maybe even and take pictures of what we're doing, and we're not even aware of it. I don't know if that's true, but it makes me a little nervous.
Yeah, I mean, if the phone's actually powered off, then there aren't many people who can who could get it to turn back on. That would be pretty difficult. But off is kind of a relative thing, right? Just because the screen is black doesn't mean your phone is off.
Right. You know,
the best bet is to physically remove the battery. And of course, if you have an iPhone, you can't even do that.
So we're up a creek without the paddle. Gotcha. Okay. All right. But okay. So part of what I try to drive at with you, and I know Dr. J does too, is not so much trying to be personal, but what would you do in this situation? Because you have this vast knowledge, and we're laymen at this stuff.
Well, it occurred to me when you're talking about the refrigerator and the light bulb and everything, is there a new... labor niche here that every family is going to need their own IT person. I'm serious.
Yeah, I believe it. I'm just thinking I can see the guy living in the refrigerator.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that right now you almost do, but that really needs to change, because that becomes a huge class differentiator, right? People who have the money can be secure, but if you're poor, you're out of luck. That doesn't seem very acceptable. But, you know, there are some good things. For example, the Wi-Fi in my house came built in with the ability to set up a separate guest network, which is firewalled off from my main network. And so, for example, when I attach some smart device, you know, some new cooker that has internet connectivity, I attach it to the guest network, which I don't care about. So even if it does get hacked, it doesn't get access to my data. And so there's some, I think, some simple defaults and architectural decisions that companies are starting to make that makes it much easier to do things in a way that is sort of secure from the outset without having to be an expert. Because any security system that relies on the user understanding security and doing something clever is sort of pre-failed.
So in essence, then, what happens, we have to keep up with the experts to the extent that, I mean, there seems to be opening up some kind of a niche for, like, people that really understand what we can do to make ourselves safe. And, you know, the language barrier. The MIT professor, for example, who knows what to do, or in your case, you do, like a separate setup, your guest setup as opposed to your main setup. But we don't know that stuff. So somebody's got to translate that. And I think that's one of the great things about you coming on the show, because we always learn. I feel a little bit safer when we do the show with you.
Yeah. I mean, now we translate it. Hopefully things are getting better so that we won't ask the users to have to understand it that well, right?
Right.
You know, when you get in your car, you don't need to understand how the fuel injection works to
exactly.
drive it.
Exactly, yeah.
Security really needs to work the same way.
Thank you for that. Thank you, because that really does put the responsibility back on the owners, inventors,
the manufacturers,
and innovators. Yes, yes.
The manufacturers, those who are, yes. just like we have discussed in terms of safety online, on networks, that the parties reaping the benefits, making the income and revenue off of the service or the product, should know what the words cost of doing business mean, and that there are certain responsibilities and accountability that should go along with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. So the analogy then, of course, is that we use the old brick and mortar analogy of even a wealthy company like Walmart. If we walk in there and there's an oil slick on the floor, they have some responsibility, where we're hoping that the online precursors take on some of that. But it's an uphill battle, isn't it?
It is. I mean, the analogy that was brought up at this event was, we're waiting for sort of the internet Ford Pinto moment.
Oh, okay.
Right? You know, where suddenly everyone goes, wait, it's not acceptable that every time this car gets rear-ended, everyone dies in a fireball.
Yeah,
you know, it's not acceptable that every time I turn on my Wi-Fi, the hackers own my entire house.
Right.
You know, that's just not a reasonable starting point. And, you know, normal users doing normal things should end up in a secure situation, not an insecure situation. That should sort of be the default behavior of all these devices.
Ooh, I like
and,
that.
And hopefully that expectation is evolving.
That's brilliant. The Ford Pinto. Oh, wow.
Thank you so much, Lance, for joining us today. And we thank you, our listener, for joining us also, our most important guest. And we look forward to talking with you again, Lance, and, of course, all our listeners. Until then, please have fun and be safe online and off.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on The Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests, and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.